walks like an animal, talks like an animal, must be an animal. Come hear the animals, talking animals, talking animals. Must be an animal. Come hear the animals. Talking animals. Talking animals.
Good morning. This is Talking Animals. Happy National Dog Day, or to hear some tell it, International Dog Day. Either way, we salute our canine friends today. I'm Duncan Strauss, and my guest today is Patrice Jones, co-founder of Vine Sanctuary, a 100-acre facility in Vermont that's distinctive in multiple ways, very much including its philosophical underpinnings. For example, Vine is an acronym for Vegan is the Next Evolution, and Vine describes itself as an LGBTQ-run farm animal sanctuary that has worked to build bridges between the animal advocacy and LGBTQ liberation movements. Patrice is also a scholar, writer, activist, and educator. We'll discuss Vine Sanctuary and any number of other topics, perhaps including the links between sexism, racism, anti-LGBTQ bias, and speciesism, when I speak with Patrice Jones in a few moments here on Talking Animals. Also later in the show, I'll speak briefly with Lisa Watney, captive wildlife manager with the Humane Society of the U.S., about the complaint the USDA has filed recently against Dade City's Wild Things for numerous violations of the Animal Welfare Act. As we've discussed on this show countless times, some pretty egregious things have been happening at Wild Things for years. Maybe their number is up. Lastly, I want to say a few words about Merle Regal, the phenomenal and hilarious crossword puzzle constructor who died on Saturday after Regal moved to Tampa several years ago. He and his wife, Marie Haley, invited me to lunch a couple of times. They really enjoy talking animals. And it also turned out Merle, a longtime Southern California resident before moving to Florida, had been a fan of my work as a writer-critic for the LA Times a zillion years ago. This sort of blew my mind because this was Merle Regal, a bona fide genius of the crossword puzzle world. I've been stumped by parts of his puzzles for years. There's much more to the story, but the main point is that Merle Regal was a very warm, very kind, very bright man, not to mention every bit the wonderfully witty raconteur you'd imagine based on his deeply funny, endlessly entertaining puzzles. My condolences to Marie and the rest of Merle's family. Right now, let's turn to talking with Patrice Jones about Vine Sanctuary and an array of related topics with a reminder that I invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663, emailing us at dj@wmnf.org, or texting 813-433-0885. Let's welcome Patrice Jones back to Talking Elms. Good morning, Patrice.
Good morning, Duncan. It's great to talk to you again after all these years.
I know. Well, I'm just going to say, because I said this to you in an email, that a better part of 11 years ago, I'm not even sure if it was a counterpart to the conference I just saw you at recently, but anyway, I saw Patrice speak at more than once at a conference and was totally blown away. Invited her on the show. We had a nice interview. And then I lost track of her, and I thought, whatever became of her cool sanctuary, Eastern Shore, and all this other stuff, not bright enough to realize that she had relocated, that the sanctuary had had a new name, and she was around the whole time. I just thought she might have moved off into academia or somewhere else, so was thrilled to sort of relocate her at the recent National Animal Rights Conference and went to virtually every single talk that she gave. So, anyways, having said all that, let's devote a moment or two to tracing Vine's history, which, of course, dovetails with your history. Give us sort of the nickel tour of how the sanctuary was founded originally back when it was Eastern Shore and sort of what prompted it back then.
Oh, great. My former partner Miriam Jones and I had moved accidentally to the part of the country where factory farming of chickens was invented and perfected, the Delmarva Peninsula, where they kill and cut up more than a million birds every day. And so not long after moving there, we found a chicken by the side of the road and found ourselves with nowhere to take the chicken. In fact, a local refuge, a local sanctuary, when we called to ask, we found a chicken, what should we do? They said, have a nice dinner. So we took the chicken in. and got help from United Poultry Concerns. Karen Davis helped us all along from the beginning, and from Farm Sanctuary and others. We gradually began taking in birds from the local poultry industry. Not many, many birds fall onto the roadside from the transport trucks headed for the slaughterhouse. Many escape into the woods when the chicken catchers come to get them. And we did have some opportunities to also actually go into some of the chicken houses, as they call them there. So we became a chicken sanctuary on about 2.5 acres of land, literally surrounded by factory farms. We grew there to take in anywhere up to about 200 birds at a time, usually less than that, fewer than that. And it was mostly chickens, although we did take in some ducks from a foie gras factory rescue and the occasional turkey. We also, while we were there, were the first sanctuary to devise a program for rehabilitating former fighting roosters who were previously considered too incorrigibly aggressive to be allowed to live. We figured out how to help them learn to live peacefully in flocks again. So we were there for 9 years, a little chicken sanctuary surrounded by factory farms, and a number of factors, including our well running dry and really not being in a property that was ever intended initially to be a sanctuary, we eventually decided to relocate the sanctuary. We were very much hoping to begin to offer refuge to survivors of dairying. As feminists, we were very concerned about the various forms of gendered exploitation of animals, so not just cockfighting, which is all about masculinity, but also keeping hens in egg factories, and also dairying. So we really, really wanted to begin to offer refuge to survivors of dairying, and Vermont is dairy country. Vermont is also at the time and still did not have another farmed animal sanctuary, so we went ahead in 2009 and relocated to Vermont, at first onto a small property, and then with the help of a very generous foundation, we were able very quickly to get a hold of the land that we now occupy, which is about 100 wooded, hilly acres, on which about 500 animals live. That includes 40 cows, hundreds of chickens and pigeons, and smaller numbers of sheep and turkeys and geese and ducks and emus and guinea fowl, and I'm sure I'm forgetting somebody.
Well, out of 500, there's a good chance. Yeah. But okay, so that's perfect, Patrice. If we could, let's leave for the moment. We're obviously going to come back in some detail about Vine Sanctuary, but let's leave that right there at that moment and sort of get into having kind of briefly at least established a sanctuary storyline. Let's explore the Patrice Jones storyline for a bit, which obviously we can, I'm confident we can sort of fasten those two together pretty easily in a moment or two. But where did you grow up?
I grew up in Baltimore City.
Okay. And is there a pivotal incident or series of incidents that launched you in the direction of caring for animals and or activism at a fairly young age, as I recall?
Well, you're thinking of the story that I often tell about when I was 15, and so I will share that. But I will say that when I was very young, when I was just a toddler, we lived on a naval base, and our house was an informal dog sanctuary. I'm mentioning this since it's National Dog Day.
Yeah.
And so our house was the house where people who were moving off the base would leave dogs, and then people who were moving onto the base would come and adopt them.
Wow.
So I do have a pretty visceral memory of being a very small child surrounded by like a pack of dogs.
And how long did that period last where you were sort of the informal dog sanctuary?
You know, I don't know a lot about it.
Oh, okay.
And I know that house, even when we weren't in it, still served that function.
Oh, I see.
I'm not really able to say about that.
Right. So it was almost more about the house than the occupants at a given time, it sounds like.
Yeah, but what I remember, my point is that I do definitely remember being surrounded by a pack of dogs, much bigger than me, and feeling, you know, utterly safe in their company.
Okay, cool.
I quit eating meat, as it happened, the same year that I went to my first gay rights rally, which was 1976, the year I turned 15, but this was all in the summer, so I would have been 14. And at first I treated that as just a coincidence, that those two events, deciding to quit meat and I can't say that I came out because I was never in, but certainly becoming much more public in my queer advocacy. I used to think that those were just, it was just a coincidence. But the more that I thought about it, when I really started thinking about the intersections between different forms of oppression, which of course include both speciesism and homophobia, I realized that there was a pretty deep link. Now, some people would think that these are sort of opposite actions. On the one hand, by coming out, by going to a gay rights rally, I was reaching for my desires. And then on the other hand, they would think that I was denouncing a desire by deciding not to eat meat anymore. But that's really not how it happened at all. Mm. In fact, they were exactly the same process of reclaiming my own desire from socially constructed desires. The dominant culture told me that I should want a boyfriend. I didn't want a boyfriend. The dominant culture also told me that I ought to like hamburger. But when I really thought about it, I did not, in fact, want to kill a cow. Not at all. And so this process of quitting meat was not a process of denunciation of desire, but rather a process of reclamation of desire. And it's that kind of process that leads some feminists who are also animal advocates and anti-racist advocates, to talk about veganism as a form of decolonizing one's own body from the socially constructed desires, including the socially constructed desire for animal products.
You've said a lot there, and we've sort of plunged headlong into some other stuff, so we may just kind of keep going here, just because part of the thing that just from some distance or some age and alleged wisdom, but as you were describing the thing about the desires, I sort of thought that deciding to quit meat was actually, heeding a desire, not foregoing one. But again, if you're 15, you might not see it that way, but with a little bit of distance, I mean, and obviously, that's clearly what you're articulating now. They were really pretty much parallel moves, even if they seemed opposite.
Yeah, and even at the time, really, it was a feeling of, ugh, no, I don't want that.
Yeah.
I don't want that. And it can be tricky because, a lot of people, they do want, in terms of the sense of having a craving for some sort of meat or product. I certainly, I quit meat at that time. It was much later in my life that I became vegan, and I certainly struggled at that point with cravings for cheese, which had sustained me through much of my adult life. So this leads us into it's a really tricky area, but it's a tricky area that feminism has already looked at a lot, which is wrestling with the fact that our desires, which are embodied, may be socially constructed, often are socially constructed, don't arise in a vacuum. They feel like they start in our own body, but in fact, they're a function of social processes. And so once we realize that, then we can start to see something like the craving for meat as what it is, a result of a certain process of socialization starting very young in childhood, and one that we might, like any other process of socialization that we encountered in our early lives, that we want to question and think about whether this really is what I want, right? It's the same process that we should be going through when we think about do we really want all of these plastic products that are polluting the ocean? Do we really want them? I mean, at some level, we've been schooled to want to buy things all the time, but is that really our most heartfelt desire? Do we really want to spend our entire lives working to make money so that we can buy junk that will end up in the ocean? To me, that's the same kind of question as, do I really want a cow, kill a cow, so that I can experience the quick and fleeting taste sensation on my tongue?
Yeah. Well, a couple things. One is, first of all, I can't tell you how happy I am as you're talking to have this nice, cool soundtrack in the back of what I believe at least are roosters crowing. So that is the coolest thing. But
you can hear them. I actually went upstairs inside a house to try and cut down.
No. If anything, I should probably get closer. But anyway, because one of the things that you sometimes say in some of your talks is desire drives everything. Mm. And I think the point you're just making is how that works at that moment or how that manifests itself is the critical thing. I mean, that's obviously kind of a cool general statement, but then how you apply it is really where things get sort of significant.
Right. And I should say, just as a sort of shout out, because the things we're talking about here are a bit too complicated to cover in any depth in a short interview.
Sure.
Like this. But
yeah.
Those words, desire drives everything, actually are the first words in a chapter that I recently contributed to a newly published anthology called Ecofeminism. And that's edited by Carol Adams and Lori Gruen and includes many different chapters by scholars and activists who are really interested in the intersection, the intersection between speciesism and other forms of oppression, including sexism, racism, environmental despoliation, etc. So I really encourage folks to look at that book. If you're curious about my thinking, you can see it elaborated in my chapter, but you'll see many, many, many other extraordinary ideas by extraordinary thinkers. And again, the book is Ecofeminism, edited by Carol Adams and Lori Gruen. Getting back to the substance of this, desire drives everything. This is a point that I make from a lot of different angles.
Mm-hmm.
One angle that concerns me frequently when I am talking with other animal advocates is the degree to which we sometimes make the mistake of believing that people are special, superior animals, different than all the others, even when we're arguing against that idea. Oftentimes, instead of treating the people with whom we are interacting in hopes of advocating for animals as the animals they are, as embodied creatures who have desires that drive everything, we treat the people we're interacting with as though they were disembodied mind, who can be persuaded by means of rational argumentation or, in the latest fad within animal advocacy, little social psychology tricks to get people to believe things. And this, to me, is both likely to be ineffective, and we've seen many times how it's ineffective, and also dangerous, because the subordination of animals by people is based on a certain logic, and that logic tells us that people are not animals, that people are more rational than animals, that bodies are all about animality and we should be embracing our very fine minds instead. It's the mind over matter mentality. And when we play into that, we're supporting the same mindset that oppresses animals, even as we're trying consciously to undo that subordination. So I think we have to pay a lot more attention, both for practical and theoretical reasons, to people's emotions and particularly to their desires. Everybody wants to be happier. Everybody wants to have better relationships. Everybody would like to feel less disconnected. Folks may or may not be conscious of the degree to which they feel lonely and disconnected from the rest of the world. But everybody wants a feeling of connection. That's the deepest happiness that animals like us, social animals, can have. And if you show people ways to tap into that deep desire, if you sort of open up the way to get what they really want, which is much more fundamental pleasure than the fleeting sensation of the taste of cheese, then I think we have a lot more success than simply making arguments all up in the head. If that makes sense.
Yeah. No, absolutely does. And let me quickly just let folks know who might be just tuning in. My guest is Patrice Jones, co-founder of Vine Sanctuary. If you'd like to ask Patrice a question or offer a comment, please call 813-239-9663. Email dj@wmnf.org or text 813-433-0885. So in a slightly different sense, in terms of connections and information about Vine, the website, your Twitter feed, etc., the description includes the phrase LGBTQ-run farmed animal sanctuary that has worked to build bridges between the animal advocacy and LGBTQ liberation movements. Now, I'm not witty enough to frame a joke asking which came first, the chickens or the LGBTQ operating philosophy, but to what extent did this aspect evolve over time? Because maybe I'm misremembering, but I don't recall back, and this was obviously some years ago still, but in the Eastern Shore days when we spoke, or even just otherwise, that Eastern Shore at least was designated that way. So can you kind of trace the evolution for me of that and how that sort of connects to the other connections we're sort of talking about?
Sure. I just want to say, just following what I was saying before,
yeah.
Again, deep things that are too complex to deal with in such a short time. There are two other books. One is my most recent book called The Oxen at the Intersection, which looks specifically at a failed effort to save two animals and sort of shows how some of these things that I've just been talking about can help to explain why we failed to save the two oxen known as Bill and Lou. So that's The Oxen at the Intersection by me at Lantern Books. And then there's another book called Entangled Empathy by philosopher Laurie Gruen, which looks at the role of empathy in animal advocacy. So back to your question about which came first, LGBTQ or chickens. I think chickens... Oh, I don't know, but...
Yeah, I'm partly being glib about that.
Is that Eastern Shore Sanctuary was founded by two lesbian feminists.
Yeah.
And that was always true. Our identity as LGBTQ folk who had, prior to starting the sanctuary, done social justice work was right there.
Yeah.
From the very moment that we crossed the road to pick up a chicken, who then crossed the road to come home with us. And so we were already schooled, deeply schooled, in thinking about intersections among different forms of oppression. This is kind of new for people within animal advocacy to be thinking about, but within feminism and anti-racist activism and other forms of social justice work in which Miriam Jones and I had been enmeshed, this is a very common way of thinking and one that's been developed since the 1980s. And so, of course, we immediately started thinking about the intersections, noticing the ways that the poultry industry oppressed the local people as well as the animals, noticing the way that the local poultry industry despoiled the local environment as well as hurting the animals. And also when we first started taking in fighting roosters, noticing the degree to which cockfighting represented a kind of sexism as well as a kind of animal abuse, a kind of using animals as a way to socially construct a particular kind of masculinity as inherently aggressive and combative, and not just using but abusing animals as a way of bolstering that stereotype about gender. So that was always there for us.
Yeah.
I would have to go too long into the personnel. There are now five people who live here. There's Miriam and her partner Aram, who's trans. There's Cheryl, our full-time animal caregiver, and her spouse Kathy, who volunteers to do social media work and take photographs for Vine. And of course, many folks, mm-hmm. who are LGBTQ are among our wider circle. And yeah. plenty of straight folks, too, plenty of straight allies. So it's been there all along. We did realize a few years ago that this was something that set us apart, and it was also something that was, to a degree, responsible for the ways that we are strikingly different from other farmed animal sanctuaries, and so we decided to highlight that
mm-hmm.
more.
Yeah.
So it was always there.
Right.
You might just not have noticed it, but now we're highlighting it a lot more.
Yeah.
Because it does distinguish us.
Okay, well, that makes sense. Because, yeah, of course, if you knew the history of Eastern Shore with you and Miriam launching it, yeah, that part was evident. But, yeah, it does seem like,
right.
as you've said,
and,
that...
Oh,
no, go ahead. No, it just seems... No, your turn. You're the guest.
And starting in 2002, even though I was doing radio interviews with you about things about the sanctuary, we were doing workshops called Queering Animal Liberation
yeah.
all over the country. So it might well have been that I talked to you, and the very next week went and did an interview about queering animal liberation, but I just didn't discuss that with you.
Sure. Well, so here's yet another thing that we can't properly address in our allotted time. But again, these might be things for people to, again, explore more or look at some books, as you've already mentioned, because some of the thing that you just touched on, I think, is really important, tied to the links that you sometimes address in talks or in writings between sexism, racism, anti-LGBTQ bias, and speciesism, which
mm-hmm.
is a really interesting area. And again, to do it justice, we don't have anywhere near enough time. But again, even to just sort of begin the exploration of it, I think is really interesting in the context of the conversation we're already having.
Sure, sure. So I will say that the book I just mentioned, The Oxen at the Intersection, devote a whole section to the idea of intersectionality and breaks out issues like racism, sexism, ableism, as they played out in that particular incident, along with some more general information that would help people to think through this topic. So I really do recommend that book. The author's proceeds, in fact, do not go to me. They go to Vine Sanctuary. Where to even start when it's so big and
yeah.
time is so short? What I would say is that what we're looking at is our mindsets, our ways of thinking about and being in the world that simultaneously contribute to multiple forms of oppression. And because each of the different forms of oppression is rooted in this mindset, if you just sort of hack away at one of the forms of oppression, but you don't look at the underlying mindset, then you're actually not going to solve the problem. And this also helps us to understand how it is that the different forms of oppression often jump up to bolster each other. So I can't talk about all the different ones.
Sure.
But we've already talked a bit about sexism, a little bit about homophobia and the reclamation of desire. So let me talk about ableism, just to give you an example. So this isn't the intersection. This is just one of them,
mm-hmm.
okay? Many people, either consciously or unconsciously, but very often quite openly, justify the exploitation and subordination of non-human animals by human animals by reference to some special capacity or capability only possessed by people. Yes? They'll say that people can, only people can make tools, or only people are conscious, or only human people, I mean.
Mm-hmm.
Only humans have consciousness. Only human beings can think. Only human beings can imagine a future and remember the past. Only human beings are rational. And of course, animal advocates know that all of these are not true statements. Animals also make non-human animals. Some non-human animals also make tools. Most non-human animals are not only conscious, but are conscious because of exactly the same brain structures and architecture that we have. Including birds, as different from us as they may seem, their basic brain architecture is the same, and their consciousness is probably very similar. So these are false statements. But even if they weren't false, they're still problematic. The idea here is that you become worthy of concern or eligible for rights, however you might want to put it, only if you possess a particular capacity or capability. That's ableism. That's exactly the same kind of thinking that has underlie the exploitation and discrimination against people with disabilities for centuries upon centuries. People with disabilities have been dispossessed. They have been locked up in institutions and forced to work without pay. They have had their reproductive choices circumscribed, all under the exact same idea. If you can't communicate like we can communicate, then you are not worthy of our concern. You don't possess rights. If you can't think the way that we can think, then you're not worthy of concern, empathy. Right. You see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So if we don't go for that underlying assumption, then even if we do manage to make some progress in disability rights or make some progress in animal rights, but we've left that basic assumption unchallenged, then the problem continues to persist.
Yeah. How far can you actually go if the fundamental thing is still untouched largely?
Yes. But this also opens up beautiful, beautiful opportunities for collaboration and coordination among folks who are working for different kinds of liberation. That's sort of the upside of understanding the ways that all forms of oppression are interconnected. The downside is that it makes it a lot more complicated to think about. It's not such a simple process to solve problems. The upside is that the more accurate and comprehensive and I would say ecological understanding that you have of the problem you're trying to solve and how it relates to other problems, then the better able you are to see other people and organizations with whom you might work on areas of shared concern.
Yeah, well, and here's, you know, as you're talking, I mean, this is going to flip this on its side and by design, but something that just popped into my head as you were describing some of this, as you said, we did touch on sexism already before I got into ableism, but since racism and other elements are too, but let's just look at racism and sexism. I mean, in a way, given that those are important parts of this discussion and, you know, your talks and writings and stuff, is there any way, I can't even believe I'm sort of saying this, but this may take us somewhere interesting. Anyway, to place the whole Donald Trump mania in any sort of context. I mean, just yesterday alone, got into, you know, not one but two confrontations with Jorge Ramos about immigration and you know, famously had him removed for a time. And the same day he tweeted all these things, a new round of insults about Megyn Kelly, you know, whatever you think about Fox News or Megyn Kelly. I mean, the thing that I just find like, you know, just run-of-the-mill armchair psychologist would be sort of overwhelmed by the implications of the like favorable response that this guy has engendered. And people keep saying it's going to stop. I mean, you can't say those things. You can't insult entire groups that regularly without collapsing. And it hasn't. So I'm just wondering, in light of some of the things you're saying, I mean, what if anything, does value at least, does this say about sort of the body politic, about culture, anything? I mean, it's, you know, it says things about the media for sure.
Yeah. Okay. So first, I just have to say that any comments I'm about to make will be made by me personally, voicing my personal opinion, and not by me as a representative of Vine Sanctuary.
Okay, that's quite a disclaimer. I can hardly wait to hear what follows. Okay, good.
No, just the point that as a 501c3 nonprofit,
gotcha.
Cannot and
yeah.
do not support or work against candidates for
yeah.
elected office.
I gotcha.
And Vine has no position on Donald Trump
okay.
or on any other candidate.
Sure.
But I, as personally as Patrice Jones, I certainly can say that I'm really interested in what's going on here, sort of obsessively interested
yeah.
in what's going on here, and it is really alarming.
Yeah.
But not surprising. Really alarming, but not surprising. And anyone who's surprised hasn't been paying attention. But to the point of intersections, certainly Donald Trump has used animal names to denigrate women. This is one of the most common intersections that we often point out, calling them fat pigs or silly cat, silly hens, or whatever the case might be. I think he said fat pig. And we're certainly seeing a self-aggrandizement by means of denigrating the other that is built into, which seems to be built into his personality, and to which other people are a significant number of other people are responding. But I think even more, so we could go on and predate, analyze
for sure.
The various intersections on full display, not even subtly, in the proclamations of this particular politician. But I want to actually get back to what I was saying before about desire drives everything.
Sure.
About the folly of not paying attention to emotion. Because actually what we're seeing among progressive responses to Donald Trump, and even mainstream conservative responses to Donald Trump, are people writing endless op-eds where they scratch their heads and say, "How can people think this way? Don't they? Can't they see that he's not making any sense? Can't they see that he says he gets his policy prescriptions by watching TV, and that that's not a smart idea for someone who would be guiding national policy or whatever the case might be?" And it's all up in the head. They're all saying, "Why aren't they being more rational? Why aren't they being more rational? Why aren't they being more rational?" Because we're not rational animals.
Yeah.
We are not rational animals. That's a myth about people. It's the myth that that we use to hold us above all the others, but it's not true. We're deeply social animals, profoundly emotional animals. We make many of our decisions without non-consciously, and then only afterwards come up with some rational explanation for why we decided what we decided. And if those of us who would like to make profound change continue to act as though people are not profoundly social animals who can be gripped by forces arising from their social group rather than themselves, or who can be gripped by some person or product that seems to be the answer to some desire that they have, then we're not going to be very successful. So I sort of come back again to encouraging us all to be truly anti-speciesist and demote people from human beings from this with this idea that we are this superior disembodied rational mind that just drives our bodies, and instead see us as animals among other animals, do a lot better job of figuring out what kind of animals we are, and a lot better job of grappling with what kind of animals we are, which is profoundly social animals, profoundly emotional animals.
Yeah. That might be, for now at least, the place at which we need to lead this. And again, I was very torn. I know. I'm sorry. We're actually
a downbeat.
No, but here's the thing. I no, because the,
but we're also. I'll say this.
Okay.
The other thing about what kind of animals that we are is that we're capable of extraordinary, what they call behavioral plasticity. Yes, people do. People have done, still do, dreadful, hurtful things to each other, to other animals, to the planet. People build concentration camps, but people also start farmed animal sanctuaries,
yeah,
and wildlife refuges and National Dog Day.
Mm-hmm.
People are also capable of extraordinary kindness, extraordinary generosity, extraordinary altruism, so we don't need to end on a downbeat note. This is a practical problem. We simply have to figure out how to engender the social circumstances that will lead people to be more generous, more empathic, more compassionate, not just to non-human animals, but to other people.
Yeah, and that's obviously even a better place to leave it. And again, I sort of torn about the Donald Trump thing would have popped into my head. I thought, okay, this is going to sully this otherwise very cool and important conversation we're having. But then I thought, well, in some ways, it's tied to some of the links and desire drives everything or whatever. In a weird way, it may take us somewhere. So anyways, I still don't know if that was the best thing to introduce, but I think
this is the beautiful thing about radio. It's ephemeral, and you talk about what's on your mind right now.
Yeah. Well, and again, a lot of things you were saying, I just sort of thought, oh my God, this one way to maybe connect some of these things in a sort of weird, at times awful way would be the Trump phenomenon. So anyways, okay, we've been speaking with Patrice Jones from Vine Sanctuary. And again, the website for Vine Sanctuary is vine.bravebirds.org. And her books that she mentioned, one that she's contributed to is Ecofeminist. And her own book that is out is Oxen at the Intersection, which I've got to get because we talked more than a little bit on this show about Bill and Lou and that whole situation. So I'm fascinated to read what your book is about that. So Patrice,
and you can find us on Facebook and on Twitter as well, Vine Sanctuary, bravebird.org.
Yeah. Okay, cool. Well, Patrice, thank you so much, and I won't lose track of you because we gotta do this way more often, and we'll come back and cover stuff in more depth and then hopefully talk about at least one or both of the books the next time and really dig into it. So thank you so much for making the time to join us today on Talking Animals.
Thank you so much for having me.
In a few moments, we'll speak with Lisa Watney, Captive Wildlife Manager with the Humane Society of the U.S., about the complaint the USDA has filed against Dade City's Wild Things for several violations of the Animal Welfare Act. Right now, it's time to step into the Talking Animals Comedy Corner. This week featured a comic we've presented previously, Tom Papa, but playing a piece of his that we've never aired before. This is Tom Papa with a piece called Diabetic Cat on Talking Animals.
Cats, loves them to death, loves them. One's healthy, one's diabetic. Yeah, diabetic cat. That wasn't even a term 10 years ago. That was called new cat. And a healthy cat, does that even exist? All a cat does is eat and then almost throw up all day long. Just walks around the house 24 hours a day. Ha! Ha! Would you ever hang out with a human being that did this? Ever? That was a really good meal. I'm good. Want to go see that movie? I was thinking we should. That's the healthy one. The other one, $3,000. Find out it was a diabetic cat. $3,000. And when they bring it back, it's not a healthy cat. It's still a diabetic cat. We have to give it shots of insulin in its neck 2 times a day. Put pills on the end of a stick, shove it down its throat, fire them in there. It's biting and peeing on us. I wouldn't do this to keep my wife alive. I wouldn't. I'd be like, baby, we had a good run. We really did. I don't want to remember you this way. Get in the carrier. We're going for a ride.
That was Tom Papa with a piece called Diabetic Cat, taken from his CD Live in New York City. Now to briefly discuss the USDA complaint filed against Dade City's Wild Things. From the Humane Society of the United States, where she's Captive Wildlife Manager, let's welcome Lisa Watney to Talking Animals. Good morning, Lisa.
Good morning, and thank you for starting my morning with Tom Papa. I love him.
Oh, well, there you go. Cool. Yeah. Okay, so let's jump in since we don't have a whole lot of time. First of all, even though we've talked about it more than a few times on the show, what is Wild Things, both ostensibly and in real life?
Well, it's a we classify Dade City Wild Things as a roadside zoo. People go to look at exotic animals that are caged, and also one of the features this place offers is allowing people to play with and swim with and have their photographs taken with baby animals, including baby tigers.
Ugh, okay. Yeah. So, now what's the history? Because in this area, we've been aware for some years of just the sort of awful things taking place there, and the most egregious being the Swim with Tigers program. Mm-hmm. But what steps does a situation like this travel from local sort of travesty to more national awareness to then more recently now the USDA filing a complaint? How does that work typically, or at least how do you think it worked in this particular situation?
Well, typically the process is extremely slow. The U.S. Department of Agriculture is the agency that regulates these types of facilities. Its own agency audits have identified that it does a very poor job of that, that there's lax enforcement and the whole enforcement process is very slow. So Dade City has been cited by the USDA for a number of years now for improper handling of the tigers during these kinds of interactions. But they've continued business as usual, and the the USDA has finally filed a complaint against the facility, which is really notable. People need to understand, because the USDA does operate so slowly and has very poor enforcement of the Animal Welfare Act, the fact that they've finally filed a complaint against Dade City is very significant. This is a big deal, and it's long overdue, frankly.
So since that is a big deal, what are the implications of that complaint? I mean, what might really this mean for Wild Things? Would it shut it down, at least temporarily? What will the impact really be at Wild Things?
There's a wide range of possibilities. This will go before an administrative law judge, and there will basically be a trial. Both sides will get to present their case, and the judge will decide what the penalties will be. That could range anywhere from a fine of a few hundred dollars to thousands of dollars. It could mean a temporary license suspension, or it could end up with Dade City having their license revoked permanently. And certainly that is what the Humane Society of the United States would like to see. We feel that they've demonstrated that they have very little concern for these animals that are used in these programs. They've refused to comply with the warnings that they've already been given by the USDA. It's time to put them out of business permanently.
And if you were a betting woman, Lisa, what do you think the prospects of that most extreme action being taken?
I'd say they're slim.
Yeah.
Sadly.
Okay.
We have to hope that will be the end result, or at the very least that the USDA will act on a petition that has been sitting on their desk for the last 3 years, asking them to simply do away with these public handling sessions with animals altogether. And that would bring an end to it, not only at Dade City, but at the many other facilities across the country that also mistreat animals in this way.
Yeah. Because again, for people who maybe just hadn't heard on this show or otherwise what goes on there, as Lisa mentioned, there's things with tigers, but I mean, the most notable is the swim with tigers thing, where it's tiger cubs in a pool with people, you know, customers, I guess you would call them. And these tigers, if you see any kind of video or you find out anything about it, they are terrified and just scrambling to the edge of the pool. And I mean, that's just, you know, one of many, many things that go on at Wild Things. So at least it sounds like you're thinking that even if they're not shut down entirely, a reasonable expectation would be at least that handling and some of the things that go with that would be eliminated.
That would be our biggest hope, because,
yeah,
again, Dade City is not the only place that does this, and if the USDA took action on our petition, it would bring an end to the practice at Dade City and everywhere else. It would bring a lot of relief to a lot of baby tigers.
Yeah. So, Lisa, is there anything we as listeners and people who care about animals, obviously, can do, or at this point, does the hearing sort of just take action on its own, and there's nothing we can do to sort of either voice support or step up in some way?
Not for that part of it, but
yeah,
what people can do is obviously not patronize places like Dade City Wild Things or any of the other facilities that offer these public handling sessions with animals, and help spread the word to others that they are, these places are miserable for the animals who are used, and, you know, get the word out so that your friends, your relatives, your neighbors, nobody wants to go to these places. That's another way that we're going to bring an end to this practice.
Okay, cool. So we will watch with curiosity and optimism and see what happens next. And we will urge people, of course, to not patronize any, you know, Wild Things or anything like it. And Lisa, thank you so much for making the time to join us and kind of explain some of this better to us at Talking Animals here.
Thank you very much.
Okay, take care.
Bye-bye.
Coming up at 11 on WNF, it's Rob Lori and Radioactivity, now rolling into the noon hour. Constitutes a full 2 hours of interviews, phone calls, news, and more. Meanwhile, as the prize for Name That Animal Tune, I'll be offering to National Dog Day, a copy of Matthew Gilbert's wonderful book, Off the Leash, A Year at the Dog Park. Right now, it's time for animal news and announcements. We'll just hit a few quick ones here, including I did hear from the folks at Pasco County Animal Services, who are just packed to the rafters at their shelter with dogs and cats, and trying to do everything they can to find homes for as many of those as possible. So they've been doing a sort of waived fee adoption event in recent days, and there's another big one sort of where that will culminate this Saturday from noon to 4, and even up through 6:30, I think that waived adoption fee will be honored. So go to PascoCountyFL.net to find out more. Also in honor of National Dog Day today, There'll be all kinds of action at three different Pet Pal locations. You can find out more about that by going to petpalanimalshelter.com. And lastly, there is a fungus that's affecting salamanders. We talked about this some months ago with our salamander expert, Matt Illerbeck. And anyways, there is a important study that needs to be done to sort of keep this out of both Europe and the U.S. You can go to savethesalamanders.com to find out more information. All right, it's Name That Animal Tune. The first person who calls in 813-239-9663 can get a copy of Matthew Gilbert's book, Off the Leash. This is, of course, a guy who had a birthday yesterday.
A long time ago, a part of you was broadcast by...
And we are reaching the end. I'll take any guesses off the air of Talking Animals on WMNF Tampa. We'll see you next week.